Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and co-parents of all ages, this podcast is for you. Introducing in the center ring, the amicable divorce expert, Judith Weigel.
When I was with the circus and enjoying Acts of Illusionists' wonderful and entertaining magic act with handkerchiefs turning into doves and women presumably being sawed in half, I never dreamed I would be watching a circus of a divorce to the level of the Erica and Tom Girardi divorce. It ended up being a marriage of financial illusion. In this episode of Celebrity Divorces, we're going to discuss the financial aspect only of the divorce today with Lorna Mouton Riff, Director of Financial and Forensic Services with CBIZ Los Angeles, enormous, enormous firm. And next month, on July 28th, we'll have an attorney on to discuss the legal aspects of this divorce. Lorna, thank you for joining us, and thank you for being prepared as much as possible to explain the financial side of what we're reading in the news.
Thank you for having me, Judith. It's my pleasure.
Well, you know, when we had our colleague meeting 2 Wednesdays ago, Lorna and I have belonged to a group of mediators, therapists, lawyers, and Lorna as the forensic expert. I got to know Lorna well, and we interviewed her a year or two ago on this podcast in her work as a forensic accountant dividing a business, and that was a wonderful episode. When this topic came up, because of course I watched the Beverly Hills Housewives, this is the Beverly Hills area. I feel we're obligated to watch TV shows about Beverly Hills. Obviously, other people are not. But I brought it up in our meeting thinking, of course, everybody would be on to this, especially the part where tracing of money, I mean, hiding of money from a business in order to, or filing for a divorce to cover up money that may have been misappropriated from one of the spouse's businesses. Lorna said, well, I do this all the time. I mean, this is not unusual. This actually happened. So I said, bingo, you are the person to come and talk about this. So in order to start and let everybody know, catch everybody up on what we're all reading online, I first of all want to quickly run down the timeline of events important to know before we get into the financial discussion. And then I'm going to read through 2 articles asking for Lorna's input as we go through the article. And the article focuses on the financial aspect of Tom and Erica's life, setting the stage for the divorce to be dealt with in a little bit. So here's the timeline. Erica and Tom marry in 2000. It's Erica's second marriage. It's Tom's third marriage. And they move into the San Marino house, which is where we've seen Erica and Tom in the Beverly Hills Housewives. San Marino, by the way, is the very upscale area of Pasadena. And it's just drop-dead gorgeous there. It's so lovely. Okay, so they marry in 2000. In 2007, Erica decides to go into performance. Now, she always wanted to be a performer, but she had a son to raise, and she married Tom, and that's where she really spent the bulk of her time. When the son was no longer a minor, 2007, Erica embarks on her career as a performer, and her first dance single called Roller Coaster hits the dance charts and goes to number one. Then on August 11th, 2009, by the way, my birthday, Erica releases her debut album, Pretty Mess. Remember the name, Pretty Mess, as we go on. 2011, Erica opens her company, EJ, for Erica Jane, because that's her stage name, Erica Jane, EJ Global Enterprises, Inc., because obviously this business of being a dance pop artist was rapidly growing. In 2015, Erica joins the cast of the Beverly Hills Housewives, and that's when I find out about her. I had no idea who she was until then. I had known of Tom Girardi because he was the the lawyer featured in the Aaron Brockovich movie over the lawsuit with PP&E, I think. But that's where I first heard of Tom Girardi. All right, now we're in 2018 to 2020. Here's where it gets serious. Allegedly, there's been the $20 million loan from Tom Girardi's law firm, Girardi Keese, to Erica's company, EJ Global. And at this, in the same year, that was 2018 to 2020, but in 2018, Erica's book, Pretty Mess, launches and is a New York Times bestseller. Well, she's already had three seasons on the Beverly Hills Housewives, plus her dance recording career, so she's primed for that. Now, last year, May of 2020 and September of 2020, Erica was asked to be to sit for two depositions regarding Tom Girardi's civil lawsuits with misappropriation, focusing on alleged misappropriation of clients' monies from personal injury awards they never got. In November of 2020, Election Day, Erica files for divorce. In December 2020, Tom Girardi's law firm and their legal issues was made public. The legal issues have been going on for a while, maybe the past 5 to 10 years, but just made public in December of 2020. On January 25th of 2021, and you're definitely going to have to address this as we get into it, Lorna, Erica opens up Pretty Mess, Inc., and supposedly transfers monies from EJ Global to Pretty Mess. And in my little remedial mind, I'm thinking, okay, there's, you know, the illusion is starting. The illusion is underway, and we'll see what Lorna has to say. So let's run down. Oh, let's get into the article now. We got the timeline. Let's go to the article now. And the first article I'm going to go into really has a ton of financial stuff, Lorna, focusing on bankruptcy. The title of the article, Erica Jane is using her glam lifestyle to hide financial assets from her husband's bankruptcy case. And that I found on Yahoo. But they also reference other sources. So, Lorna, we're going to be talking about the bankruptcy first. And because you work in the field of divorce, as I do, when you have a bankruptcy case and you know there's going to be a divorce case, does the bankruptcy have to be dealt with first before you really get into, well, what do we have for the divorce to divide?
Well, I think the issue has to do with, are both parties going to be filing bankruptcy, or is only one of the parties going to file for bankruptcy? It makes a difference, right? If both parties are filing for bankruptcy, then you're going to deal with the assets and all the debt in totality as part of the divorce in conjunction with a bankruptcy, because there will be some, you know, depending on what the structure is, there may have to be a liquidation of assets to satisfy creditors, and there may at the end be no assets to divide or limited assets to divide. It depends. Now, and that's probably the more common situation that we see. The next one that we do see occasionally is where only one party files bankruptcy and the other party doesn't. This gets tricky because, and this is a situation that touches on this Girardi case, which is that there is a look back rule under the bankruptcy laws. So if the trustee of the bankruptcy look, they are allowed to look back in time. Generally, they look back 24 months to see if there were any significant assets transferred from one party to another. And they'll, so in a marriage, that one's easy. They'll look to the spouse or former spouse to see if there was a transfer made. They can also look at transfers to family members, you know, and particularly they can look at situations where an asset was sold, but sold for a value that makes no sense, right? So, for example, if you have, let's say there's a house, and there's a, instead of selling it on the open market, that the house is sold to a family member or a close friend. And let's say that the market, under all the surveys, the market shows that the house is worth $1.2 million. But they sell the house to this family member or to this friend for $500,000. Bankruptcy trustee can look at that and say, that might be a concealment type sale, you know, where they're transferring assets to protect it from the bankruptcy, and they could undo that transaction. So it's not too different in this divorce situation, where if one party, and there have been cases where people have gotten divorced and transferred all the assets that they had to one spouse, and the other spouse got all the debts. And that's the settlement deal that they make, right? Meantime, the party that got all the debts files for bankruptcy and says, I don't have any money. Woe is me. You know, trustee will look at that and see that assets were in fact transferred to the spouse, and they can do a clawback. So the clawback means that they can still go after those assets that were transferred, especially if it's to spouse, former spouse, because that they can make a case, if you will, that this is simply a cover-up. You know, that they filed the bankruptcy to just protect the assets, so they were all given to this one person. In this Girardi case, you've got another level to this, which is you have the bankruptcy court level, where they may be, you know, and I'm not speaking to, you know, I have no opinion whatsoever about what's going on in this case. I don't, you know, I'm not involved in it in any way. So I'm speaking more generally as to, you know, what happens if people do these kinds of things. So if you have a bankruptcy in a marriage, maybe they're trying to conceal some things. And you have an issue of an embezzlement, you know, a potential embezzlement of funds, where you have a whole nother level of creditors that are entitled to money that are coming after somebody. You've got two branches that can come after assets in this, you know, in a situation like this. You've got a bankruptcy court, and you've got the civil action with all of the creditors. So, and it's also my understanding that in this particular case, assets have been frozen. Nothing has been seized yet, but they have been frozen. So that diminishes their access and ability to move anything around. And I think to your question about, you know, you mentioned that Erica had set up, she had an original entity, EJ Global Enterprises.
Yes.
And then more recently, she opened a new enterprise Pretty Mess Inc. And if she did transfer the assets of the prior entity into the new entity, she's now contaminated both. And that the bankruptcy court and the civil action can come and investigate and do a tracing. You know, it would not surprise me if there is not already or will be a team of forensic accountants, much like in the Bernie Madoff case, to investigate and trace where money came from, what the source of monies were. And this goes from the law practice to the individuals, to any entities they may own or trusts, and down into assets. And if they make a case, they can seize the assets.
Okay, so a couple. This is great, Lauren. It's so nicely explained. And I did learn years ago, in my practice of mediating and filing, that, and I was told this by a bankruptcy attorney, that if you know a divorce is imminent, but you are so heavily in debt that you and your spouse would be crushed on community debt, I was told, let them file for bankruptcy first. Even if they just filed for divorce, freeze that. Let them go into bankruptcy first, dismiss what the court will allow to be dismissed, and then look at what you have left over to deal with maybe as community debt, since we're in California and it's a community property state. And debt is community property like assets. So it kind of sounds like that's what you're saying too.
Exactly. A sequence that makes more logical sense for people. Like, let's figure out what the court will adjudicate and see if anything is left, you know, that we have to divide or take care of, you know. And like I said before, if things have to be liquidated or sold, or assets are going to be repossessed, you want to know that before you start dividing things up. You know, you really do want to know what's going to be left.
Right. Right. Well, just look at this. So in terms of bankruptcy, could you clarify for us the difference between voluntary and involuntary bankruptcy? Because the only bankruptcy case that I'm reading about right now, it's called an involuntary bankruptcy case, and it's Tom's law firm, which has now been closed, and clients have been appropriated to other law attorneys. So what's the difference between voluntary and involuntary bankruptcy?
Literally, it is what it sounds like. So a voluntary bankruptcy is when a debtor, individual, or a company recognizes that the debt that they owe is so much greater than the assets they have, and they're just buried, and they cannot come out from under that without filing for bankruptcy. And they proactively go ahead, hire an attorney, you know, and file for bankruptcy themselves, maybe work with some of the creditors. An involuntary bankruptcy is when the creditors get together and say, you know what, there is way too much debt here, and we're going to force this company to file for bankruptcy so that we can at least maybe get 2 cents on the dollar, maybe, you know, get something, and they will get together and force the filing of a bankruptcy, but from the creditor side, if you will, which is basically what you're saying has happened here, is they recognized that they were so much money owed, they want them shut down.
Right. So what I'm reading is being owed is not only awards that have already been granted in a couple cases from the Girardi Law Firm. If I'm reading this correctly, Boeing made an airplane that failed. Lion's Air was driving that Boeing plane, and it crashed, and 189 people died. And I think it took off out of India. And so there's that, but there's also this other subsequent case going on or filing. I can't remember the name of the law firm that's doing the civil lawsuit against Girardi Keyes, because when a personal injury case is being executed, the attorneys running it, so Tom Girardi, maybe his partner Robert Keyes, need other professionals like yourself. You are hired on to cases as a forensic specialist to trace money, to figure out what's going on financially, and you have to pay those people. Those people weren't paid, supposedly, allegedly. And so we have this now we have this bankruptcy case, I guess forced by the law firm filing for clients and creditors of Tom Girardi. And by the way, Erica has her own bankruptcy law firm representing her in this case,
which I understand they
pulled out of, and then they came back on. So they
I can't keep up with this. This way, this moves so fast.
It's my job to keep up, Lorna. That's my job here. Not to criticize or judge, but to use aspects of these cases for people that come to us, because this stuff really does happen. That we just are looking through it through a celebrity lens, but it's stuff that happens. So, yes, Dinsmore, and I forget the partner, wanted to substitute out once the Hulu special Housewife and the Hustler came on, because there is attorney-client privilege that they felt was being ruined by this show. And then they came back. They picked the case up again. So anyway, so she has attorneys representing her in this particular bankruptcy. Okay, what is a trustee? Quickly, what is a trustee? You mentioned that. It's mentioned in these articles. In the bankruptcy case.
I'm probably going to be terrible at defining this, because I won't be defining this with legal terminology, since I'm not a lawyer. But a trustee is someone who's given the responsibility to discharge either, you know, to act with authority, if you will, over an estate, or could be the trustee of, you know, a bankruptcy, could be a trustee of an estate. It could be a trustee of, trying to think of another situation where there's a number of situations where you have trustees.
Well, this is the trustee of the bankruptcy, and you kind of mentioned it when you were talking a few minutes ago. But can there be more? Is the word an idea of a trustee? Is it multi-purpose in something like this?
Well, they serve different roles, but basically they are put in charge, if you will.
All right.
And they have it's a legal, you know, it's a legal. Their role serves a legal purpose, and so they take on, fiduciary duties. If they're the trustee of an estate, for example, you know, they are given authority to discharge the assets of an estate, and they have to account for it, and you know, answer to the beneficiaries. Just like a trustee in the bankruptcy has to, you know, there's a legal responsibility here that goes along with that.
Well, you're absolutely right, and here's why. In the article, it says a bankruptcy trustee is now liquidating Girardi, talking about Tom, Girardi's assets to pay back creditors, according to this Hulu special, The Housewife and the Hustler. They have also asked for special counsel to recover assets from Erica Jane.
Right, so that's where the clawback is going to start happening. It wouldn't surprise me if you at some point if it is found that assets came from the company that should have gone to the creditors and the victims, if you will, mm-hmm. right? And it trickled into Erica's business and into some of her assets. Right now there's a freeze, but once they ascertain and confirm that they can demonstrate that there is a direct line to these things, then the freeze will become a seize. and then they will start liquidating, right? And what's interesting is I double checked this morning, but the provision for what can be sold, in other words, what can be sold and what are people entitled to keep? So what people are entitled to keep is very de minimis. So for example, you can keep a house as long as the loan is under $5,000.
Okay.
That's for starters.
All right.
You can have, and their view of what your basically it's basic needs, which is defined very differently than people that are living at the level that Erica and Tom are living at.
Yeah. It's a 16,000 square foot house, and it's on sale for almost that much money, maybe around $13 million. And Lorna, you said exactly what I'm reading. This is brilliant. The trustees' special litigation counsel has already confirmed Girardi transferred $20 million in loans from his law firm, Girardi Keys, to Jane's company, EJ Global, according to the motion filed on Wednesday, which was a week or two ago. I can't see the date on this article, so you nailed it. And it further says the trustee is now attempting to uncover the location of millions of dollars of litigation settlement proceeds or other law firm assets, which may have been fraudulently transferred to Erica Jane.
Now, I'm going to throw another little wrinkle in this whole thing, which hasn't been mentioned yet. So, right now, they're looking at the fact that money wasn't paid to the claimants in these class action suits, and money was, air quotes, loaned to Erica's company. Now, I guarantee you, the taxing authorities are sitting back and watching this and waiting. And yes. The reason is they're going to want to know, is there some component of this that represents undeclared income at some level? So the question is, and it's multi-leveled, and I don't know the answer to this because I don't know the structure and I don't know how things got paid. But let's say, for example, when the money was received on behalf of all the claimants, how is it reported? How is it recorded? Because normally, I'm using family lawyers that I'm familiar with by way of example, but I understand that this applies, you know, generally to lawyers. If they receive money that's not theirs, you know, that is, say, their client's money, or in the case of these class action lawsuits, that's belongs to the claimants, that money goes into their client trust account, or they create a special client trust account that's just for those claimants, right? Especially when you're talking about the kind of money that we're talking about here. So the question is, when the law firm received the money, how is it recorded? Then the next step is, when it was paid out as loans, they may deem that, they may say that's a constructive salary, constructive income to Tom, because they can't pay Erica, you know, they can't charge Erica with salary from a company she doesn't work for, but they can charge Tom with it, that money represents a payment to him of income. And they could say that they owe tax on the amount of those loans because they will not be able to be paid back. So we've got a bigger mess, and it's going to cover, you know, a bit longer of a period of, possibly a bit longer of a period of time to straighten it out, like what happened in each of the years.
Right. And it wasn't a lump sum $20 million loan. At least this is what the articles say. It was spanned over a 2-year period, it stated 2018 to 2020. And no, you nailed it. A couple things with what you said just now, because I was wondering when the IRS was going to get involved and confiscate bank accounts. I was just wondering, when does this happen? And you provided at least an event triggering when this could happen. But first of all, is it normal for a company to loan a relative of a partner or owner of that company? Is it normal to loan them money? Have you seen this in your work with other cases?
I would say it's highly unusual. I have in my divorce work seen situations where a law firm, a single lawyer law firm, so there weren't multiple partners, but a single lawyer law firm was loaning funds to a related, to another entity that they owned that was involved in a different non-legal enterprise. So let's say, for example, you have a single attorney law firm, and let's say maybe they're in the entertainment business, and they're also doing some producing in addition to practicing law. So they might have another corporation that handles their producing work, and maybe the law firm will make an investment, if you will, in the production firm and maybe make loans, but technically it's all related. It is unusual to see a law firm with multiple partners because they have to answer to each other.
I know, that's what I was thinking too. You have a lot of people involved in a large law firm, the accountant, the manager, the partners, you have a lot.
Well, the part, so I mean, mostly it's the partners, because the partners generally have their own operation agreement as to, you know, it covers, you know, how much each of them are going to be paid, how much, you know, if there are loans, if there, you know, it covers generally day to day, you know, how we're going to interact with each other in business. So it is rare to see it is rare to see loans being made. I'm guessing that on the books, it would have to be indicated as a related loan to Tom Girardi, though.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then what he does with it is up to him.
Correct.
And the payback terms would have to be agreed upon somehow if it was done like that, I would assume.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
This article that I'm looking at continues with, as each day goes by, Erica has been publicly dissipating community assets by selling her clothes on public websites. I hate the use of this word, flaunting large jewels on social media, like on the Beverly Hills Housewives, on television. And my question about this is, you started bringing it up too. Well, what happens then as the tracing of the money proceeds and you can trace this alleged loan to purchases she's made, maybe the funding of her record company, things like that, costumes. I mean, you have to wear clothes on stage. They're expensive. So if you're selling these things and it's connected that these things were purchased with this loan, where does the bankruptcy court and go from there? Can you get them back? The clawback, is this where the clawback?
This is the clawback. So if there's a sale, and by the way, my latest read is at the moment, everything is frozen and she is forbidden from selling anything.
Like okay, not, I didn't read that, but thank you for that.
She is not supposed to be selling anything. I read this morning, what little I did read, she's not allowed to sell the clothes. So she's actually not supposed to be selling anything. She should not be liquidating anything. And if she does, they can still seize the money that she got from the sale.
Oh, that's right. Of course.
You know, okay. That's assuming that she then doesn't, you know, turn around and spend it somewhere else. You know, so at the moment, everything is frozen. Once, you know, I shouldn't say once. If it is then deemed that these are, you know, in fact, assets that are the product of the $20 million that was loaned from Girardi's firm and should belong to, that the $20 million in fact belongs to the claimants and creditors, then it is not impossible that the parties will be issued a notification that now that all these frozen assets are going to be seized and they will be auctioned. So I guess you could think of it in terms of that scene in, is it Schitt's Creek?
Oh, yes. Schitt's Creek.
You know, where they, in the very beginning of, you know, one of the first episode, I think, where the feds come in and they basically take everything, and that's what they can do now. So, but what'll be interesting is there's going to be layers here, because you've got the layer of the creditors and this potential, criminal action, possibly, right? And so you've got that group who want to get the assets so they can then pay the claimants. Then the IRS is probably going to be sitting back and waiting, because they have to wait to see if any of this triggers taxable income, right? At that point, they're going to come in, and whatever's left,
oh wow,
they're going to take. They could take. So it can get messy.
It can be a pretty mess, couldn't it? Okay, so a couple things on that. This book, Pretty Mess, that was published in 2018. Can the proceeds from that be looked at as payback for this loan, anything that would not be confiscated?
It's an asset. So the book has publishing rights and royalties, and that's an income stream that can definitely be garnished. And so that any of the royalties that come in later on that book will go directly to a fund to pay back the creditors.
Okay. And does it matter? Oh, services. Before I ask this other question, services. So a lot of the money was to services, hair and makeup people, and recording, sound engineers. Money paid to services, these people don't have to worry typically in a bankruptcy like this?
Well, if they provided services, then that's gone. You know? Okay. I mean, that's services. Now, if they, let's say there was money paid to someone to make costumes, then it's the costumes that can be
right, because that's the hard asset.
Right, so it's really about assets that they can get their hands on.
Right,
but also including intellectual property because the intellectual property that she has generates income, right?
Right, the songs, the book. What about, is she in a bankruptcy? Now that we know all hard assets are going to be looked at and possibly clawed back, what about the work she's doing on the Beverly Hills Housewives as income? Is she at least allowed to live on something like that? It's not huge, but it's something.
I don't know what they're going to do about that, and I don't know what kind of money she's making.
I don't know her specifically, but reported income on a lot of these shows is around $5,000-ish per episode per character.
I don't know what they'll do with that. I really don't know. Because understand, as I mentioned before, we have, and especially in Los Angeles, and particularly, you know, if you're talking about, you know, the wealthy areas of our city. Mm-hmm. Our view of dollars is distorted in a sense that the IRS's view, you know, if you just think about any other part of the country that's not a big city, you know, the IRS's view of what people need to live on, okay, is
more like what we need to live on.
is very, very different. You know, it's just very, very different. I mean, so what they're going to do about that, I have no idea. I don't know if they're going to say it's current personal service, you know, it's current personal services of Erica, you know, to perform, if you will, and appear on the show. So she's being compensated. I don't know what, I actually don't know what rights they have to her compensation, because that's really what it would be, is compensation to her current compensation.
Right. And well, I mean, people do have to earn a living and live on something. My understanding of bankruptcy is that you're not supposed to be completely homeless and destitute, maybe so that you can pay, keep working so you can pay back more money. I don't know. Just guessing.
The numbers of the threshold of what they consider what you need to live is not even what it costs to live in Los Angeles. Mm. I will tell you that.
Okay.
So it's much, much less.
Okay. So in a traditional bankruptcy case, and quite often in a lot of marriages, Lorna, as we both know, one spouse really doesn't know what's going on financially. They just trust that the spouse making the money is doing everything right and bringing home the bacon, and everybody's eating it, and it's fair and square, and nobody has to worry. And then what happens? A divorce is filed for, and you could easily see, oh my God, we were living on debt. We weren't really living on current income being generated, or at least there's some income, but certainly not anything to the extent that we've been living on. And now you have both people signing off on joint tax returns, and you have to provide this information, right, when you're exchanging your financial statements in a divorce and your asset and debt statements, and a new reality is now in front of you. And the innocent spouse is just saying, holy heck, what do I do? Oh my God, where do I go? I thought I was going to get spousal support. I thought we had these pensions and these IRAs to divide. Are you serious? We have to give this back?
It happens. Oh, I've seen it happen. And the tragedy of it is, yes, the spouse that had no knowledge of this is blindsided. And has to figure out how they're going to restructure their lives after the divorce. I've had situations where we found out that the debt was greater than all the assets that the people had, and so basically we were just dividing up debt and having to, you know, ask these people to liquidate everything. And you know, it's shocking, and it does happen. It's frightening. It happens. And truthfully, I've had situations where I've appeared in court on cases where maybe not quite as dramatic as this, but cases where the court realizes that the parties lived be well beyond their means during the marriage, you know, constantly, you know, on one of the little, you know, hamster wheels, if you will, trying to keep up with the monthly payments on credit cards and loans, and still finding ways to get more money so that they could keep this up. And the court is not inclined to force somebody to continue that, to keep the
marital standard of living.
The marital standard, because it was artificial.
Yeah.
And that's a big blow to people, because they think, well, this is how we lived. And I have to explain, yes, I understand. This is how you live. But you weren't actually in this economic bracket to live like this. You you, if you had lived only on what was earned and what you had available and didn't run up all of this debt that you cannot possibly, you know, cannot be repaid in a reasonable amount of time. You know, that's artificial. Can't be maintained, and you can't ask somebody to continue that. And that is a shock. That is quite a shock to try and explain to a client that, no, actually, you are probably going to have to find, you know, somewhere you're going to have to find an apartment in LA for under $3,000 a month for you and your two children.
And good luck on that.
And
in a safe area.
In a safe area. And by the way, you're going to have to go brush up on some skills and get a job.
Yes, you know? Shocking.
And it's like, well, the children are young. I'm like, you're going to have to figure this out. The courts are not going to be sympathetic because this is the reality of your life, you know? So, yes, this is, I have found myself in that situation a few times. It is not pleasant to have to break that news to your client.
I know. I mean, even on my level, which is not yours, Lorna, with the cases that I have, I've had some large cases, but mine are kind of regular income people that can sort out their own stuff. But I did have a case, regular income people, where the debt was unbelievable and the wife had no clue the level of debt. But it was one of those cases where just sign here on the income tax form, honey. And she did, and it went out. So she had really didn't know anything about, are we in a negative or positive net worth situation? Then it came, and they had two small children. So with all the minimum payments to the 30 credit cards or something like this, with the income that it was with husband, okay, I know what the DISO master ran for child support and a starting number for spousal, but there's no money for this unless you declare bankruptcy. And so then you're in a situation where it certainly is not my business to encourage people for bankruptcy. You have a different level of conversation with people. As a forensic, you are there to have these difficult conversations. I'm not. And so in a gentle way to just explain, this is a reality I know you didn't expect. Take some time to think about it, because the normal divorce laws going forward can't fulfill themselves for you. It's not here. It's not available. And that's right. Just so sad to right. Sit and watch this conversation. Okay, I did want to ask one little question about this. So, allegedly, loans came from Girardi, Keese to Erica Jane, and she used the money. Does it matter in regards to liability whether she knew the character of the money that she was getting, that it perhaps may not be from Tom's paycheck or the firm's profit? Does it matter at all in liability to Erica?
I don't know.
Or the recipient of the money.
I don't know, but I'm guessing that if there are pending criminal charges, then that may weigh on how far down the pipeline, if you will. So for example, you know, Erica's is just getting something that she's assuming, you know, she may not have had no knowledge whatsoever what that money represented, other than, you know, here, you can have this to, you know, get your company off the ground, you know. So I don't know the end answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm guessing in the coming months, we'll find out. We'll find out, because that's part of what's going to happen. You know, they're going to be talking to everybody, and their goal is to find out who knew what when.
Right. And, well, she has to keep on living and working. There's no question about that. I know what I was going to ask. So in parts of these two articles, I was reading that for some reason, Erica did not sit for these depositions in May and September, and there was no reason given why they really... Why nothing happened as a result of that. So that's one thing I found interesting with the depositions for bankruptcy. But I did find it interesting, and you can comment because it has to do with the financial aspect of a bankruptcy. She was asked to turn over bank statements, I guess for EJ Global, because Pretty Mess didn't open until January. Maybe that too, but she was asked to turn over bank statements, and the article alleges she did not. So in a situation where the bankruptcy court is asking for bank statements and you say no, what does that do to you?
I know in my cases, when we ask nicely the first time, we always say, ask nice first. Okay. And if you get an affirmative no, then, you know, I have the lawyer send a subpoena. And that subpoena can go to the individual. I don't know how the bankruptcy court works, but in, you know, in family law, the easiest way to get bank records is we subpoena the banks.
That's what I was going to say. Wouldn't they just go to the bank then? I mean, they're there at the bank.
Right. Well, so you have to know what banks, though.
Oh, of course.
You know, you have to have some information, right? You have to have some kind of skeleton information as to, I may not know the bank account numbers, but I know that they bank at ABC Bank, you know, EFG Bank, right? So that a subpoena could be prepared to these banks and basically say, please provide the statements for a person with going under these names, right? Mm-hmm. You give every iteration that you have of the person's name and their social security number. And so that's typically what we'll do is like, okay, we know they're at these banks and I have the lawyers issue subpoenas to these various banks. So,
as a forensic detective, a financial detective, if you will, because that's why I look at you as a forensic accountant, as a forensic detective. If no information about banking is provided to you through social security numbers, or can you work through the IRS or the state to look at the statements, the income tax statements, to see if banks have been provided as part of the filing, yearly filing?
So I don't know. So I only know family law. I don't know the right, you know, I don't know the legal availability of different vehicles, if you will, in criminal cases. But in family law, we don't really have, that's not a recourse for us.
Oh.
You know, like we can get copies of prior year's tax returns if we didn't get them. But we have to have our client make the request. Mm. Like unless we have power of attorney, I can't request them, right? So we have to have authority from our client to make the request for the prior returns. So I'm not quite sure I don't know what recourse is available in these instances.
Okay, understood. As a forensic, do you ever talk to witnesses or other people who can provide information for you if you're trying to trace the money? Or can you only go to entities? Do forensics talk to witnesses? It's a note I made. And if so, how does this work? Because it says in this article, the trustee, as the court document stated, in order to uncover the whereabouts of potential assets of the estate, including the location of millions of dollars of litigation settlement proceeds or other firm assets, which may have been fraudulently transferred to Erica Girardi, also known as Erica Jane, the trustee must examine witnesses who may have firsthand knowledge of this widespread fraud. So I know that's the trustee, but if they bring forensics or people like you on board, do you ever get to talk to other people when you're trying to find the money, or not really?
So we do. But generally, I rely heavily on the lawyers that I work with to set that up for us. So, for example, there's levels. So I call it the play nice stage. So the play nice stage is I call my lawyer and I say, okay, so it looks like so-and-so company has been doing their tax returns for, you know, the last 10 years. So they're pretty knowledgeable. Do you think you could arrange, could you ask the other attorney to give us permission to request information from them? And could we maybe talk to them because they could be helpful? So that's the play nice stage. And if there's cooperation, the other lawyer might say, sure. No, we don't have a problem with that. You know, they represented both parties and we'll share all of that. Now that goes to personal returns. When you get to the level of businesses, the tax preparers cannot just give us that information. They have to have permission from the corporate officers, the owner of the company. So we have to have cooperation at a few more levels, if you will, to get that next level. But again, on the play nice stage, everybody cooperates and they say, sure, we want you to have this information because it'll make the case not cost as much, it'll go faster. We're not going to give you anything unless we're going to make you fight for everything that you want. Then on that level, I have to do a whole document request. I send it to my lawyer and then they turn it into a demand, you know, a formal demand for production of documents and serve it on the other party and maybe also have to serve it on their business and then possibly have to do, you know, the third party notification, you know, it's that whole triangle of notifications. But I can't do, you know, unless we get cooperation, I can't reach out to anybody directly.
I get it. Are you ever part of depositions? Do depositions come up when you're trying to sort out the details financially of a case?
Yes. So more often than not, if I am not asked to be in on a deposition, I will ask. I personally like to be in on the deposition of the other spouse or the person, you know, person's most knowledgeable with regards to the businesses and whatnot. And truthfully, I think it's helpful more often than not for the lawyers to have us there, because sometimes questions are answered and there's an answer that we see a lead into that the lawyer might not see. Just because we have a different level of maybe we have a different level of understanding of the structure or something, you know. So I will ask, and we are there more often than not.
Well, Lorna, we are at the end of our time. This has been quite an enjoyable discussion. I have once again, learned more than I knew going into a discussion with you. And here's how I describe you. You are a brilliant forensic accountant, parenthetically financial detective, with a heart. Lest people think forensic accountants, and I don't know, I mean, I know a few in town, but you are different because you actually care about people. And I find that so heartwarming that I would love for you to give our listeners a way of getting in touch with you if they have cases that have any aspect of this case, or if they're going to be filing for a divorce and they know there's some financial complications going on, how would people get in touch with you?
So I could most easily be reached through email at my office, which is L Mouton, Mouton, Riff, Riff, at CBIZ, CBIZ.com.
L Mouton Riff at CBIZ, CBIZ. Okay, very good. Go ahead.
Correct. So that's the easiest place to reach me. If they send me an email, I will always respond. And if I can't, if it's not a good fit, I will happily make recommendations for someone that they could talk to that will be a good fit. So thank you for the compliment, Judith.
Oh my gosh, are you kidding? And I meant it. You just have such a passion for helping people. And it seemed incongruent with somebody that deals with numbers. But I love that you exist and that you're part of my world. And I learn from you every single time I talk to you. So thank you for your time. I know how busy you are. Thank you.
Thank you, Judith. Thank you for having me. This was fun.
Good. I'm glad, because
this was fun.
I wish no harm on anybody. I hope this case works out for everybody involved. But for me, it was interesting and fun because it's on TV. And you know how I love anything TV and entertainment oriented. So I'm glad. I'm glad you agreed to do this and enjoyed it at the same time. Thank you.
Yeah, I think it highlights, you know, while it is this case and the case is in the news, I think it highlights some important areas that people should pay attention to in their own lives, even people not going through a divorce. You know, if you're in a marriage and you're in the dark, somehow it's important that you get information and find out financially what's going on in your marital world. It is not about trust. It is about sharing information so that you're not in the dark, is how it comes down to it. Because there's too many times that I get a client, like we have talked about, you know, where by the time they come to me, they've been in a marriage 20, sometimes 30 years, and they have no clue what has actually been going on. And sometimes it works out okay, but oftentimes it's a rude awakening. And I think people in a marriage, and that goes both ways. You know, I'm talking about both sides, both couples, because it's, you know, can be one or the other that's kept in the dark. Be proactive about asking. And I know that that's oftentimes a challenge, especially if you are the victim of what I call financial abuse.
Or financial infidelity. We had Dr. Talal Ansalan. No, somebody else. Megan McCoy and Alex Malkumian. Financial infidelity.
Yes, exactly. So for all of those reasons, I think it's important that in a marriage that you be able to ask, you know, what's going on. If something happened to you,
Death.
I want to know. I don't want to find myself, you know, struggling with something happening to you and then finding out that I have this mess to, you know, take care of. So it is important. It's very, very important.
You know, I'm so happy that you said that, because I had talked on this podcast about somebody I knew who actually, she worked longer than her husband, who had an age difference, and he retired early, physical reasons. She was giving him her paychecks to put in banks while she's working, and now he becomes very ill. She says to him, "Honey, let's make sure I know everything about our finances, because it is obvious he doesn't have long to live." And they did have the opportunity to shore up any loose ends so that she wouldn't be compromised once he passes. And there was the bank account that her paychecks went into. I guess his pension and Social Security would go into their living account, and her paychecks would go into their savings. And there was close to $500,000 in there the day of his death. She went to the bank on her own where that account was a week or two before he passed and said, "You know what? The banker said, my name isn't on this account. It's really not a joint account where my paychecks have been going." Now I have questions about how can you deposit somebody's paycheck if their name isn't on the account? But that's, I don't know. But anyway, the point being, he said, "No, there's nothing wrong. You'll get all the money." And unfortunately, she didn't get a penny. All the money went to his children from a different marriage, like within 24 hours. They were the beneficiaries. And I just was crushed for her. I was crushed. So yes, you do need to be mutually informed about everything financial that has to do with your lives. And thank you for that takeaway. That was an important one. Thanks, Lorna.
I think that's what we should, you know, from all of this, you know, for us. For us regular folks, you know, that's the takeaway.
Right. So thank you again, Lorna. And thank you everybody for listening. I appreciate each and every one of you, because with the information that we provide on this podcast, we all grow in a better way. Please, if you don't subscribe, you're just downloading, I ask you to subscribe. Please share this with your friends, family, anybody going through divorce, and anybody who may be going through divorce, because the information is invaluable that we present to you. And as always, have an amicable day. Take care.
That's our show for today. Thank you for joining us. Be good to yourselves, be kind to your spouse, and cherish your children above all else.